I think that we should all just be used to hearing expertise from the voices of women. And I think that it's the only way that we're really going to change the perception of power and who's in power and who gets to make decisions.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Emily Tisch Sussman has created a career for herself as a Democratic strategist, pundit, and podcast host. She has over 200 appearances speaking for the progressive cause on television. Her politics podcast is called Your Presidential Playlist, and it features all women guests. That has included Democratic stars like Nancy Pelosi, Hillary Clinton, and Stacey Abrams. Emily has worked as an independent political consultant and as vice president for campaigns at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, and many other places in the progressive ecosystem. We had a chance to discuss her background, career, and podcast in a wide-ranging conversation that's worth your listen. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Emily Tisch Sussman and Your Presidential Playlist.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Okay, Emily, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
I'm Emily Tisch Sussman. I'm the host of the podcast, Your Presidential Playlist. I've worked in federal campaigns, both issues and for people, over the last 15 years. I worked mostly in Washington, both on the Obama campaign and then working on legislation through the administration, and then the turnover, the switch from the Obama administration to the Trump administration, and how we worked on issues through that. So it's been an interesting ride.
It has been an interesting ride. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York City. I'm a New Yorker. So, you know, I really grew up with people who are pretty like-minded to me, but felt a little bit frustrated, felt a little bit like we lived in a bubble. Like, I think we knew that in New York, that we lived in a bubble. I had a little trouble understanding, honestly, like how the rest of the country was thinking. We had an awareness of the fact that we didn't have a great read a lot of the time on what was going on in the country, but didn't really know how to access it. And so I think that really informed my mindset when I started working on campaigns about really trying to empathize with the people that I was working with.
I mean, you didn't grow up in a run-of-the-mill family. Might as well confess that. Tell me a little about your parents.
It's a great question. So I did not grow up in the run-of-the-mill family. I come from a big and prominent family in New York City that was somewhat political, although not entirely. Actually, my grandfather was the Postmaster General of the United States when I was about five. So this Postmaster General conversation was really interesting to me in the last couple of months. He took me to the inauguration. He held me through it. I was waving. I thought that everyone was there to see me. I was like, thank you so much for everyone to see me. You know, my grandfather, my grandparents worked hard, came from, you know, moving once a month in Brooklyn because they couldn't pay the rent every month, and worked hard and built a huge company and really instilled very strong values in us that we work hard for everything. And also with the understanding that with great privilege comes great responsibility, and also that people were going to judge us differently, that people were going to assume that we didn't necessarily work for what we got. And so we had to work 10 times harder. So, you know, we had to use our platform to do good with it. And we had to measure up in every way, and we had to work twice as hard. So I think that was very informative for me, my sister, that we try to always work 10 times harder and also to use what we have to make sure that whether it's a platform to give other people a voice, an opportunity. My grandmother was one of the very early HIV/AIDS activists in the early 80s when people didn't know what it was, when they still thought it was gay cancer. My grandmother always, she just always had a lot of gay friends.
The grandma and grandpa you're speaking about, on which side of the family?
Bob Tisch, my mother's side, is my grandfather, and his wife, Joan Tisch, my grandmother. She started volunteering at what was called, I don't think the organization had a name related to gay cancer, but it eventually became the Gay Men's Health Crisis. And she started just answering the switchboard, like moving the switchboard lines around. And then she found out after volunteering there for a couple months, they were going to lose their space. And so she came in and she gave them a check to be able to keep the building. But she always wanted to do it anonymously. Like she wanted to be there to work. But then at the time when they really needed it, she really stepped in financially as well. And so that was something that really defined her and really defined me. I've always really looked up to her for that kind of, you know, both anonymous and then being able to step in when they really needed it kind of work. And I think really informed the work that I've done.
And that huge company, was that Lowe's?
Lowe's Corporation. Yeah. My grandfather started it with his brother.
Pretty amazing accomplishment.
Yeah. I mean, I respect them for moving into so many spaces. They started when my grandfather was 19 years old and started with a summer camp and then built it into a varied business, which I have respect on the corporate side, enormous amount.
Yeah, definitely. And on the other side, your dad also was enormously successful.
Yeah. So my dad was actually successful in a totally different realm. My dad worked in finance and was one of the early people to kind of develop what a hedge fund is. And he also has set a really defining example for us. His interest over the last 10 years has probably grown of being involved in Democratic politics. And again, like using his resources to help people and help organizations that wouldn't normally be able to access them. And he's always looking in his funding and thinking about how to look for where the holes are. That's been a great example for me as well. I mean, my mom really looks really on the nonprofit side and looks particularly in New York City, like how do we help level the playing field for organizations and for people? And my dad really thinks on the political side. But, you know, when I was starting, he wasn't as involved. So it's been interesting. I think our interests have kind of grown together. And it's been interesting to learn from what he's been doing and from what I've been doing and being able to share that in the experience.
I don't know if you know, I built a political fundraising software application years ago. And so I would see his name in different people's databases as a donor to our side, which we're always very appreciative of.
You had the real good insight. You had like the good intel seeing all the funding background.
I did. So what was college for you?
I went to Skidmore College, which was small, artsy. I started as a social work major. It's actually probably should have taken this as like a real sign. I almost went to art school. I wanted to be a costume designer. Huh. And so I was in a costume design class in my first semester and I was talking, not paying attention. And I sewed my finger straight through a sewing machine. Like the needle went like in and out of my finger. And so I had a sewing needle in my finger and had to go to the ER to get it removed. And I remember I said to the doctor, it was right after I started college in 2000. So that was my first election. So Bush v. Gore. And Nader was scheduled to speak at my college. And I remember the doctor said, you know, we can either do surgery or we can try to remove it. I can't remember the different options were. But I remember I said, whatever option's going to get me out of here the fastest, because I really need to get back to campus to see Nader speak.
So you were pretty politicized already.
Exactly. That probably should have been an indication for me where my interests really were. I didn't go back to the costume studio. I majored in social work and I worked all 4 years at a state-run agency for adults with developmental disabilities, which I loved. I loved the experience. I loved the relationships. But I did feel like for my clients, the social workers and the non-degreed workers who work with them really didn't have a lot of say in what their programs looked like and what their learning path looked like. Whenever they wanted a decision made, they would have to go and bring in a lawyer. And so I thought, oh, maybe one day I can be one of those lawyers. It took me, I think, longer than people would like their children to be on a path of kind of valuing my own value and seeing what my contributions could be. And so I pretty much was not very focused in college. I liked the social work. I liked working with the adults, but academically, I really wasn't very focused. And I didn't think I was very smart. So I thought that the lawyers were the ones who made all the decisions, but that I wasn't really smart enough to be able to be one of those lawyers. So it was something I had wanted to do and thought about, but and in fact, that I had a professor who actually told me that I wasn't smart enough to be a lawyer, and that I had basically just gotten everything in life because of my family. So that stung.
That must have been really hard. I mean, I would hate to have someone tell a kid of mine something like that.
Yeah, that was pretty brutal. And I think it kind of, you know, to some degree put a fire under me, but also was kind of defeating. Like, it didn't feel very good. And I had a lot of doubt. I had a lot of self-doubt. So I liked the idea, but it wasn't really until I went to go work on John Kerry's presidential campaign right after college. And that really clicked for me. It felt like all of these things that I didn't know were skills and that were useful in a workplace, I didn't even know they were skills. So, you know, organizing, being able to bring my peers along with me, being able to just like drive through the work really helped me excel in that workplace. And I just thought they were like things that were fun, you know, they were things that could actually help me. There were a lot of lawyers on the campaign and it was the first time I really felt accomplished and I really felt smart. And I said, you know what? I actually think that I'm smarter than some of these lawyers on this campaign. I think I can go to law school. And so when the campaign was over, I studied for the LSS and started school as soon as I could the next fall.
And you went to Cardozo.
I went to Cardozo Law back in New York. I wanted to be in the city. I didn't think I was ever going to leave the city. And actually, I went to Cardozo because they had a joint degree in social work, which I ended up not pursuing. I ended up not getting a master's in social work, just a JD in law.
Do you now recommend law school? Do you think that that was a useful thing to have done?
It certainly was for me. I don't know if I would recommend it for everyone because it was a lot of work. Like, it was a lot of money. Like, it really, it fried my brain, which for me, I needed my brain to be power jolted. And it really helped me think about things differently from different perspectives. One of the most impactful law professors I had is now the head of the Human Rights Campaign, Adolfo David. My law degree was in constitutional law and family matrimonial law because I wanted to focus on LGBT families and the rights that they had and didn't have. And he was my professor in sexual orientation and the law. He was there as an adjunct professor. And he said very clearly in the class, like you're letting your emotions take the better of you. And if you're getting upset, then you're not thinking clearly and you're not letting your arguments win. You're letting your emotions win and you're not making good arguments when you do that. And that like socked me in the face. I was like, but I am so passionate. Shouldn't that win something? Doesn't that count for anything? And it doesn't. So that was like a great lesson that he learned. And I think just learned just sort of all over in all of law school to be methodical, to be clear-headed, to be looking at the details and to be looking from different perspectives because bringing different perspectives makes you see different perspectives. And so I think it's helped analyzing different campaigns, different opportunities, different legislation.
You then worked in the Obama campaign doing some voter protection. Is that right?
Yeah, I graduated law school in 2008. So I actually knew that I would probably work on that presidential. I had had such a good experience on the campaigns that probably regardless of who the candidate was. So I'm not like a Obama brought me into politics kind of story, of which there are many and there are wonderful stories, but I actually probably would have worked no matter who the nominee was. And having just gone to law school, I felt like I should now use these skills and go into work in voter protection. So I went back to Pennsylvania where I had been on the Kerry campaign and had gone back and forth for the 4 years in between, worked in Western Pennsylvania in voter protection. And I thought going in, I was like, now I'm a lawyer. Like I know all sorts of new things now, but like legal voter protection is really just still organizing. It's just organizing lawyers who like to do high skilled work. Like, you know, when you do a training for them, it's a training for how to work the polls as opposed to a training on how to knock doors, but it's still really just organizing. But I liked it nevertheless. I mean, it was great to be on a winning campaign. Let me tell you, it was different than a losing campaign.
Way better. I hope we have one this fall. What was Think Blue?
So Think Blue came out of being in law school and feeling like I had been on a campaign and I knew how hard campaigns worked to try to engage people, especially young people. And that I felt like everyone around me was like having conversations about issues they cared about, but what didn't even occur to them to move it into electoral politics. Like people were talking about reproductive health that they cared about or the environment they cared about, but it never occurred to them to connect it to campaigns. So I got together with a couple friends and thought, how are we going to do this? Like, how are we going to move friends in? The first friend that I thought of the idea with is a guy named Greg Proper, who now runs an agency out of LA, Proper Daily. He does a great job. So he's still like fighting the good fight there. And so we brought young professionals together. It was like kind of a fun cocktail hour. And we would bring in young congressional candidates from all over the country. Like everyone shows up to New York to fundraise. So we would tack on an hour after their fundraising with just young people. So it was, you know, low dollar. It was affordable. it was kind of social and you got to meet candidates. And so we'd have, it was like moving people up the ladder of engagement. So, you know, first they'd go to the event, see the candidate, then people would phone bank for them. Then I remember one of my friends told me they set up Google alerts for the candidates. We got some phone banking going in for them. And I still stay very connected with the people that, it was just sort of a working group that put it together. It was a bunch of people who are now like still, we're still in the fight with, which I love. It was, you know, my sister, Rob Diamond, who's the New York State director for the Biden-Harris campaign now. Lindsay Nathan was the COO of Everytown for a couple of years. Eddie Wang is now like an Instagram star. So it was like a really great group that worked on it. And we've all kind of like really stayed connected. It was a good jumping off point. It was a good organizing point. It was also an actually a really good experience for me in leadership development that we just had our working group that we worked with and that we liked, but we didn't think about bringing new people in. And so as we all hit like our late 20s, everyone was kind of moving on to the next experience. So like two people went to business school at the same time. I think I moved to Washington. I think Rob went to work for the Obama campaign. And we didn't have anyone to pick it up because like everyone got busy at the exact same time. And so it just kind of dispersed in a friendly way. Like there was nothing salacious and nasty about the ending of it. In fact, I would love for someone to pick it up and keep going with it. But it was a very good lesson for me in leadership development.
And then Service Members Legal Defense Network?
So Service Members Legal Defense Network was the nonprofit I went to work for after the Obama campaign when I moved to Washington. So it was a nonprofit organization that provided free legal services to LGBT members of the military. So Don't Ask, Don't Tell was in place. So Don't Ask, Don't Tell was kicking people out of the military. And so we provided free legal services. It was an administrative proceeding to investigate someone under Don't Ask, Don't Tell and discharge them, which meant that the military did not provide legal counsel to them. So we were their free legal counsel. And then I worked on the government affairs side of the organization, working on the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So it was everything from working on the actual bill, like what is the language in the bill? Where are the votes? What is our vote strategy to get it through? I worked on the communications side with our communications director, thinking about what kind of stories we put out into the world. I oversaw the grassroots organizing. And then the Pentagon put in place the largest study they've ever done on personnel to find out what would happen if Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. So I was the liaison to the Pentagon on that study. It was months long. It was massive. The crazy thing about that study is that because the law was still in place, so they were surveying members of the military to find out like what would happen if the law was repealed. And service members were serving openly as LGBT, not T, that was still in place, but LGB. And the crazy thing about it, because the law was still in place, if someone came out and said, yeah, well, it affects me really positively because I could finally be open, that would be considered an admission and they could still technically get discharged. So it was a pretty wild study. So I was trying to present the perspective on behalf of our clients so that they could really work that into. And it ended up working out pretty well because the law was repealed. And that was, I mean, maybe even better than the victory of winning the Obama campaign, to be honest with you, because it was so, like, rarely do you ever have just like a clean win, like an uncompromised clean win. Although I'd say the compromise was the trans service members, and that was not a clean win. But the rest of it was really, it was great. Like, the law was repealed. It was going to take, I think, about 90 days to go into effect, but the law was repealed. And so that was such an incredible moment for our clients to know that their trajectory was going to be so different, to be able to either serve or be recognized in their discharge in a different way, because we were able to proactively change their discharge paperwork. It was a great experience.
One of the areas where we've really made progress of late, how was the Young Democrats for you? You were ED there.
The Young Democrats was my job after the Service Members Legal Defense Network. To be honest, it was a tough job. The Young Democrats of America is the official arm of the Democratic Party, but broke off from the DNC to be a freestanding organization. So it kind of had the responsibility of being the official arm, but without any of the resources. And over the past couple of years before I took over, it had just sort of deteriorated and become very localized. So trying to have one solidified organization, you know, it was a challenge when people are already used to kind of owning their own platform in their own state and their own community, that to then come in and say, like, yes, we want to be united in one organization. So it was great to be back working with young people. I loved that. It was great to be working directly towards Obama's reelection. But the specifics of trying to organize people who did not necessarily wanted to be organized was definitely a challenge. And I tried to figure out, like, what are the levers of power that I have, you know, to be able to, not power, but, you know, like, what are the positives and negatives that I have to be able to work? And one of the things that I had was communications. And so in that time, the TV network started calling me to go on and talk about the Obama campaign and whether he was going to win re-election or lose to Romney. And I realized that was a lever that I could use to be able to impact change. So I started going on talking about young people. Then they expanded the platform of what they wanted me to talk about the election in general. And that started only the last 8 years of being a Democratic commentator on cable news.
Yeah. How do you like that? I've noticed that you've made, I don't know, hundreds of appearances now. How do you like that? And why is that a good fit for you?
Those are really good questions. I like it because I don't mind being on the spot. And I think it's not as hard as cold calling in law school, which I thought was even scarier.
For a lot of people, you know, those cable news snippets are so short and I don't know, the glare of the TV is so bright, it's not a good fit. But is it something where you felt like I started out pretty good and got better, or it was rough at the beginning? What's been your feeling about your development?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've eased into it. I think at the beginning, I was really clear on making sure I wanted to hit exactly the point that I wanted to hit and not deviate from it. And I think I've kind of relaxed into it a little bit to be able to go with the flow of the conversation and still be able to work in the points that I want to make without kind of like hitting it over the head from the beginning. I mean, the segments are short. It may feel long when you're watching, but you can maybe talk only once during a segment. If there's three panelists, if the other people are talking too much and the host isn't like a good host to be able to moderate them to kind of bring people into the conversation, you could end up only talking once. And maybe the host asks you a question that you're not necessarily prepared for. So you have to answer the question whether you're prepared for it or not, right? So you can come in and end up kind of spending your time on something that you don't really feel like is worthy of the thing you want to get into the world that will make an impact at that moment. And they might not come back to you. And you just kind of have to live with that. The other thing is really you have to be very flexible about the schedule. The way they do the bookings, it can be booked in advance or booked at the last minute, and they can cancel you. I mean, there are so many times that I've been sitting in the chair ready to go on, and they're like, okay, one more minute. Oh, sorry, we're going to skip the segment. That has happened so many times to me.
That sounds incredibly frustrating. How do you prepare for such an appearance?
It's so frustrating. So you get the topic that you're going to talk about maybe about 3 hours before you go on. So I'll do a scan of, you know, I'd stay up on the daily news anyway, so that whatever the lift is, once I find out what the topic is, hopefully it's not that intense. And I can remember what articles I've seen recently to go back to it and either find more articles in the topic, or what I prefer to do is identify like what issue area it is and figure out just through my network, like who I know who works on that issue. I ask them for a quick call to talk through like the substance of the issue. So I understand not just what's happening and where we want the issue to be moving, but also what the political pitfalls are. So what am I trying to avoid getting into like a nitty gritty conversation that's actually not particularly helpful? What are the likely arguments to come up that I can anticipate against so that I'm prepared for that? So I really like to be able to talk through it with the experts before I go on, or even if they're unavailable, I'll say, you know, here's what I'm thinking. Can you tell me if this jives with what your work is?
When I played sports, I would, you know, be pretty keyed up beforehand. And then afterwards, my mood was pretty determined by whether I had hit the jump shot at the end of the game to win it or missed it. Do you have that kind of post appearance high or low, or how do you feel coming off of something like that?
That's so funny. I don't think I have a real high or low like sports. I kind of feel okay about it. Like after it goes on, I think I'll probably feel good if I feel like I really made the point that I want, but I don't necessarily feel depressed if I don't feel like I didn't really get to what I wanted to. What does happen is that I'll have like an adrenaline crash afterwards, especially because So I had my first baby a couple weeks before the 2016 election, and I've had two more since. So I've had three kids since the last election. So I've basically either been pregnant or just post-pregnant essentially for 5 years. So that just means that I have less energy than when I started going on TV, and it'll often really suck my energy to then go on TV because I have just less than I had before, and then come home. And if someone's in, you know, if one kid's in a whiny or crying bad mood, oh, that feels really terrible, to be honest with you.
Do you have like a favorite appearance or a least favorite appearance or both?
I mean, I generally like the weekend shows because you're at a round table and so you can have more in-depth conversation. It's not like get a quick hit and go out. I like to be able to both engage in conversation and be able to engage with people around me, like have an actual conversation with them. I hope that we will be sitting around a round table one day ever again, because I really enjoyed those. And I've actually made a lot of friendships out of the media appearances that I've done, both with people, whether it's like through social media or people that I've been on with. I've just like made really great friends, like with some of the hosts, with some of the other guests. I can just say, you know, I really respect the points that you make, and I really respect how prepared that you come. Like, let's vibe, let's hang out.
You spent 5 years at CAP, at Center for American Progress. What did that do for you? What did you learn, and what were you able to accomplish?
Yeah, it was actually even more than 6 years. I was there for a long time at CAP. We were able to accomplish a lot. I mean, so CAP, Center for American Progress, is the largest progressive think tank. It was started preparing for a Democratic presidency. The way it's set up is very interesting, that it's set up in different policy ideas. So there is an economics team, there is a health team, there is a climate change team. And so it's full of mostly policy people. They can vary a little bit, but it's mostly policy people. And so what they do is they're thinking about, like, what is the next big idea in healthcare? Or under the Trump administration, how do I defend against, you know, what are the points, what's the analysis we want to do? How many people will lose health insurance? How much will premiums go up? And then thinking proactively to the future, what would we want to do to fix it and even expand healthcare? I'll use healthcare as an example. But so that really solidified for me going to CAP that I am not, I mean, I knew that I wasn't a policy expert, but that I am a function expert, and also that being a function expert is a job. So the function of running a campaign, I worked across all of the different policy areas, moving from team to team to say, okay, you know, we're not just writing papers right now, but we're thinking about how to pass a law, how to get an administrative change, how to change public perception on this issue so we can get to policy change. And so treating every opportunity as an opportunity, figuring out, mapping out, like, what are the assets? What are the deficits? What is the news cycle? Who are the stakeholders? Who wants to be engaged on this? To be able to move between the policy issues really did solidify that being a function expert is a job and that I'm good at it. I think it's okay to say this is something that I'm good at doing. Every team I worked with, every issue I worked with, every moment was so different. And being able to take in all of the different factors and turn it into a campaign was exhilarating, much better when we won than when we lost. But but just being able to like solidify that as a skill, I think was really important for me. And I hope better the CAP. Now there's a whole campaigns department. So I feel good about that.
You did some convening of meetings of progressive organizations and people on our team. What did that teach you about the progressive ecosystem? How do you think we are? How well do you think we are organized and such?
We're organized so-so, I would say. We convened a lot of meetings on every issue. Like if a campaign was about to launch, we would convene a meeting with the different stakeholders, say, here, how's it going to launch it? We would set up regular meetings for those. Every kind of issue has a weekly meeting. And then the White House, the Obama White House, used to host a weekly meeting of progressives where they would talk about like what's coming up. And so organizations had an opportunity to organize around it. I took over that meeting from the White House when the administration ended and started hosting it at CAP in coordination with Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights and Center for Community Change. So I would say that who controls the agenda like really controls a lot. And we tried to make that as collaborative a process as possible. I'd say the other thing that I really, when I think about running any meeting, whether it's a progressive meeting, a coalition meeting, a meeting of my own team, is that we really need to separate out what is a meeting that is a place for ideas, like a brainstorming of what we can do, and what is a meeting that is just for function. Like, what meeting is just about everyone gets in the room, takes their assignments, and does them. Being able to separate those out and say out loud and have everyone acknowledge, like, this is a place for ideas. This is not a place for ideas. We are just at the executing point now, is everything in terms of running a meeting.
That makes sense. I hate the meeting where you waste time and people air their grievances and nothing gets done.
And there are so many of those, like an endless amount. But so we need to be able to leave meetings with action items. And so whether the action item is we've now created like a new pool of ideas that we should be working on, or whether it's here's how we are going to get this done in the next hour, we have to leave with action items. And by the way, coming with written agendas and leaving with notes are the thing that will make a meeting actually happen. Even when I would do like individual check-ins with Steph, they would have to bring an agenda of what they're working on. Otherwise, we're just sort of sitting and chatting, but we need to have structure to it.
What's ETS advisory?
So when I left CAP, I was sad about it. I didn't go back after my second maternity leave. My first two kids are 18 months apart. So I had an 18-month-old and a newborn, and I just didn't feel like the pace of my job was a fit for having two kids so close together. I mentioned that my first son was born right at the beginning, right in the 2016 election. So the first couple months of the Trump administration to the first year was just trying to keep up with the pace of the administration and trying to figure out how we could utilize the assets of CAP, like all the smart minds that we had, all the smart people to be responding and even trying to push a progressive agenda forward under the Trump administration. And it was endless. I mean, by the time we figured out a response, he would have come out with a new policy. You know, he either would have tweeted something or the administration would release something on a Friday night. And so I spent very little time with my son when in like the first 18 months. I just had to be working all of the time. And so then when I had a second and my son was starting to be more alert and actually noticed that I was spending very little time with him, it just didn't feel like it was a fit anymore. So I left and I started my own consulting firm. I'm just one person. And I just kind of put myself out there and like said to my friends, like, hey, you know, like you've always said you wanted to work together. Like now's the chance that we can actually do it. So I both put out my own podcast, Your Presidential Playlist with Wonder Media Network, and I work on individual consulting projects. And so I've been able to work with really interesting organizations that I love, with Swing Left, with Vote Vets, with Change the Ref. And it's just been really great to be able to work with people that I love, work with a variety of projects, also be able to, you know, arrange my schedule as I need to be able to.
What do people hire you to do?
It's really to work on every aspect of the campaign. So whether it's designing a campaign from the beginning to figure out how to implement an issue, I worked on a theater piece, giving sort of political guidance to it, writing a communications plan. You know, an organization wants to get themselves more higher profile visibility. I work with them. How to bring in coalition members. I work with organizations on that. So it's really been sort of across the spectrum of variety of things. And it really matters to me what the fit feels like. Like if it feels like the organization, the people that I'm working with are the right fit for what I can do. I don't want to be overselling myself as something I can't do. And also just that it's an enjoyable experience to be able to work together.
Why did you start a podcast?
I wasn't totally convinced that I was going to do it for a little while. I started doing the podcast because I felt like I was hearing the people around me having the same conversation over and over. And so that was going into the 2020 presidential primary, just trying to say like, I just want there to be a Democratic nominee, but I don't even know how to think about like who that should be. And so I started to look at it the way that I approached it. And it's the same way that I approached looking at going on TV for cable news segments. I would call the experts that I knew and I would ask them what the difference is in policy platforms and why it mattered. And like, what's realistic and what happened in the past that I need to know? And so I thought, well, I feel like other people would want to hear that conversation too. So that was kind of the genesis of the podcast, that I brought on policy experts to really analyze the difference between the policy platforms, the Democratic nominees, and compare them to Trump's platform and his record. So that was how we started it. And then we tried to think ahead to like, well, you know, now that people are voting, what are listeners going to want to hear? So we did it for the early states, for Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina to think, okay, now we understand the difference in the policy platforms. What happens in Iowa that is specific to Iowa that's going to frame the way that voters or caucus goers in that case are thinking about it? So we interviewed experts in Iowa. And then we looked to the general election and said, okay, well, everybody knows there's swing states that are basically going to define who wins and loses. What do we need to know about them? So every episode is dedicated to bringing on organizing and political experts in that state to tell us how do people organize there? What issues really move voters? The thing that is so different this year is how are people logistically going to vote? And that's actually the same for every year, I would like to say, that if you are coming in to run a campaign in a state, you have to know if they have early vote. You have to know if they vote by mail. It dictates the way you design your campaign. It's just that this year, I'd say there's more of a focus and people are opting in to different varieties as opposed to showing up in person and voting in person on election day. That's what we've designed the podcast now. We're also adding on an action item. So asking people from the state what people outside of the state can actually do to help them in their organizing. And the other aspect of the show is that when we were thinking about creating a podcast, I just felt like if I was going to be creating a platform, that I needed to have on all female experts. Women are the majority of voters, have been the majority of voters, will be the majority of voters, but still end up being discussed in political analysis like we are a mere constituency and not actually the majority. So I felt like, you know, both we should be getting our analysis from women, but also I knew a lot of women, like a lot of the women that I looked to be policy experts that in my own life and on the show were a lot of women who I considered to be the foremost experts in their fields. Many would consider them to be the foremost experts in their fields, but they just wouldn't give themselves like the extra push to get that extra shine, like to get the media appearances, to get the congressional testimony. They would kind of let other people take it. And so I felt like I was going to give it to them. Like I was going to say, I know that you're here. Don't count yourself out. I want everyone to hear what you have to say. So that was a pretty important for me piece in creating the show as well.
By virtue of your career in the space and connections, we're able to get really top tier guests, including Hillary and Pelosi and Stacey Abrams. How did you land them? What did it take to persuade them to be on your podcast?
A lot of persistence and a lot of flexibility in scheduling. Like I'll take any time. It'll be short, but like, I will come to you. I actually had been talking with Secretary Clinton's team about scheduling her on the show for months. I mean, maybe 6 months. And I just kind of kept nicely saying like, hey guys, do you remember that I'm pregnant? So I will eventually be having a baby. And then we had come like right up to when we were supposed to schedule. And I just kept saying, every time I went to my doctor for my like weekly OB checkup, I was like, keep the baby in until the interview. That's all I care about. I just need this baby on the inside so I can pull off this interview. I have a time. Let's get to it. And we were maybe a day or two away from the interview. And they were like, oh, can we push into next week? And I was like, look, guys, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm going to do this interview. So either I'm showing up to her office this week or she's coming into my hospital room next week. It's up to you. It's on you. You guys decide which one you want. But I am not giving up this interview. So I think that may have finally gotten us over the top to make it happen.
So that was in person with Hillary?
Yeah, that was in person. That was in January. The timing ended up being the week before the Iowa caucus, like the Friday before the Iowa caucus. And so that was when she had said in our conversation that she felt that Bernie Sanders hadn't done enough in 2016 to endorse her as the candidate and to bring his followers over. And when we did the interview, we thought it seemed a little interesting, but like nothing new that she hadn't said before. So I just kind of sent it over to some reporters that I knew and said like, hey, do you want to hear this? Do you think it's kind of interesting? Like, I know we're going to the Iowa caucus. And the New York Times was like, yeah, we're definitely interested. So we sent them over the audio and they published maybe about 4 hours after we did the interview. I consider this news cycle to be like every news cycle right now is so insane. Like you have to light yourself on fire to like literally be in a news cycle. So I was surprised that the interview got as much play as it did, but it ended up like playing all weekend, over the weekend, replaying the audio, like all over every cable news network. It ended up getting like multiple news cycles after that, because then Congresswoman Tlaib made comments about it at a rally for Bernie Sanders. And so it like got more legs and kept being discussed. And so I think that was like a real breakout moment for my show. Certainly.
It's got to be. I mean, it's kind of like Trump tweeting, you know, you're a stone cold loser. That kind of attention may be the best thing. What does it tell you, though, about the treatment that Hillary gets? Because, you know, you see this over and over. She gives an interview and something gets picked apart and, you know, viewed through this magnifying glass and becomes a whole thing.
That is very true. I mean, I didn't think it was remarkable when she said it. Like, I felt like she had kind of said it before, and I felt like a lot of people had said it before. And so I didn't think she was saying something that was wildly news-making, but there is just such high interest in whenever she says anything that it took on really a life of its own. I mean, to be honest, I was surprised that Congressman Tlaib was talking about it in a Bernie Sanders rally because she wasn't running. Like, if you're trying to make the case for your own candidate, like, why do you care what an old candidate said?
There's such a sensitivity in that Sanders-Clinton thing. It hasn't fully died off. It's kind of raw.
No, it still was. I mean, we had given her sort of an overview of what we were going to talk about, but not given her questions. And I hadn't really planned on like getting that deep into it. Like, I felt like it was kind of in the past.
You sort of don't want to pick at any scabs, right?
Yeah. I mean, I just didn't feel like, I didn't think that asking her questions that she had been asked before made for an interesting interview, but apparently she had new things to say and people felt like it was new things to say. I mean, I like to ask people questions that they haven't been asked before and have to like really think about. She didn't go into the interview like prepared to be, you know, like shitting all over Sanders. Like that wasn't like she didn't know I was going to ask the question. I hadn't prepared them in any way that it was coming. Like that was just it was in the natural flow of conversation.
How would you compare talking to Pelosi and Clinton and Abrams? Like, how are they different as interview subjects?
Well, I was nervous in different ways, to be honest. Like, I don't get nervous for cable news, but those three interviews I was nervous for because they are just three, just such unbelievable idols for me that I wanted to make sure that I performed well. Like, I didn't want them sitting there being like, ugh, who's this Yahoo? Like, I cannot believe my scheduler put this on my calendar. This is a waste of time. You know, like, that
I can imagine
was
that feeling. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, totally. So like I was super nervous, more so than I am normally.
Do they put you at ease or do they not bother?
I'd say the warmest entering the room, the one to really put me at ease, was Secretary Clinton. But all of them were really friendly when they entered. But like they are pros. Like they get down to business. They're like, oh, good. We had our hellos. Everyone feels good. Let's get started. You know, like they were like, I am here to get this interview done and I will get my points across. My producer had worked on a different interview with Stacey Abrams and she described her as the perfect interview subject because she gives an animated answer and it's finished. And now there is a pause. And the next question will start.
I really look forward to seeing where her career takes her.
Yeah, I mean, she's obviously just so brilliant and so dynamic and really in touch with where people's heads are and thinking about solutions based on where people's heads are. I'm excited to see what happens.
When you talk about the podcast, you say we and you mentioned a producer. What's the team?
Yeah, so I work with Wonder Media Network, which is a female-founded podcast company. I really developed the show with them going through a couple of months weeks of thinking through what a great show would look like based on their experience and where I felt like my strengths were. So with Wonder Media Network, an actual producer for the show. And then I also work with a great friend of mine, Anthony Hayes, who has his own consulting firm, Hayes Initiative, who's just been super helpful in thinking through all of it. And we have a wonderful researcher who works in the show and also makes all the beautiful graphics and social media for it. That's the team. It really is very much as collaborative an effort. Oh, and also, how can I forget Danielle? And also a great friend of mine has also come on consulting with the show, who's the vice president for race and ethnicity at CAP still. And so she brings a great amount of expertise and lens to make sure that we're asking like the best questions that we can possibly be asking. So it's a great team. Everybody works really well together. When we were in person, it was fun. I guess it's still kind of fun over the phone. But just really making sure that everyone is getting an opportunity to weigh in on what are interesting questions, what is timely, what points do we want to be making. I certainly can't see it all myself. And so I really want everybody to have a very strong voice in the process.
I talked to Jenny Kaplan from Wonder Media Network on my podcast, and it does sound like they specialize in shows about women and by women, right?
Definitely. Yeah. Jenny was the one who I initially talked to about working together on the show, and she's the one who helped me develop the concept. And I think because she works on a lot of shows that are developed by women, for women, I mean, I actually don't necessarily think of my show as being for women. I think naturally when we have all female experts, it does tend to draw in more women. And so we can see from our audience that it's a majority, but not exclusively. I think that we should all just be used to hearing expertise from the voices of women. And I think that it's the only way that we're really going to change the perception of power and who's in power and who gets to make decisions is how we, you know, we listen to who experts are. But Jenny has a great perspective on bringing it in, and her partner, Shira Atkins, has been great in the marketing side as well.
What do you do to market it? How do you make sure, you know, short of having Hillary say something controversial, that people hear what you're doing?
Well, having Hillary say something controversial definitely helps. We try to think about, in terms of marketing, like the best thing to market is just for me to be out there more and do more. But it's hard when I balance 3 kids under 4.5 and everything else. So we try to be like really judicious about use of time. I think probably the best thing that we do is podcast trades. So I'll do a promotion for one show and I'll do a reading, a promotion for their show on mine. That's probably the biggest form of marketing that we do. We have an Instagram account for the show where we post a lot of the actions and quotes. And so we think about that as a form of marketing as well, but we've never really gone like super hard on it. We probably could go harder, to be honest.
How many people do you think listen to a typical episode?
I think we have over 100,000 listeners.
What impact do you hope for from the show? What would you like it to accomplish in the world?
Well, I definitely hope it does have an impact. Otherwise, I think I'd feel like I don't really know why I'm doing this. Like, I think everything should have an impact. I hope it just helps people feel a little bit more confident in their information base and the conversations they have, so that they can really move forward in taking more steps to take action and be more involved in the democratic process, whether that means calls to senators, whether that means voting, whether that means calls to campaigns. When we were thinking about the show and creating the show, and we were thinking about what void it would fill, I felt like there was information at different ends. Like, I think a lot of people in politics, when they speak, whether it's media, speak out loud, they really want to sound so smart for their peers. And so they overcomplicate things. And then I think it becomes inaccessible to a regular person who's just trying to tune in where they can and get whatever information. Or on the opposite end of the spectrum, we have like very dumbed down information that's so simple that people don't really feel like they're taking much away from it. So I really tried to be in the middle, like have informed conversations with experts in a conversational tone, in a way that is simplified so that people can access the information and feel like they feel confident about their knowledge base so they can maybe then do that little bit of extra research if that's what they want to do to get really in the weeds on something. Or maybe not. Maybe that's the amount of information they know to then go in a different direction and try to learn something else. Or, you know, vote early to then become a poll worker on election day, or vote early to make calls on election day. We're going to start hosting a night of weekly calls so that we can like make calls together, because people like to feel like they're part of a community. And so if they feel like we've created a little bit of community by them getting to know our guests, maybe getting to know me as the host, let's do the calls together. Like, let's make calls to swing state voters together so that we feel like they're doing it with people who are like on their team, like they're feeling good about.
What gets you fired up about the political season? I mean, people in the political class are vibrating typically to just about every 5 minutes on the news. But what for you is of central importance?
When people feel empowered, when people feel like they weren't sure if they were going to be able to vote, but then they figured out that they can. When people feel like they weren't sure where they were going to vote, they weren't sure if they were going to be too nervous to make their first call, and then they did it, and then they feel great about it. If they felt too nervous to door knock, and so they just left some, you know, door knocker on the door, maybe had an encounter with someone, and then felt like, yes, this is totally something that I can do. Like, when people feel empowered, I feel great. And that gets me really fired up.
I'm constantly having people come to me and say, what should I do? I'm full of anxiety about this upcoming election. How can I be most helpful? What is your answer?
So right at this point, I'd say the answer is calls. That is the thing that you can do that is the most helpful. Every campaign will have a portal for phone banking, and that is the thing that you can do that is most helpful. Text banking's okay, but people just don't know what information to trust right now. They don't know if they should vote by mail. They don't know if they're registered. You know, people were moving around a lot this last couple of months, and so the voter registration might not be correct. And so the ability to have somebody call and just ask you, like, just take a moment to pause and ask the questions, like, do you want to walk through the voter registration? Do you want to walk through what your voting plan is? I think is making a huge difference. Because even of the people that want to vote, I don't think everybody's going to be able to, because they're going to get confused. And people aren't aware of the fact that you can vote in person in many states now when you weren't able to ahead of time early. So voting has already started in Pennsylvania, in Virginia, Minnesota. Like a lot of these swing states, voting has started in person. So being able to make sure that you are calling voters to see if they know that, if they have a voting plan, it's going to be at a different location that you vote at normally because there's fewer voting centers early than there are on election day. So making sure that you can call people and have that conversation, like a nice, friendly conversation. I know people are scared of like calling and like getting yelled at, but it's just a conversation about how you're going to get that vote in is critically important. The most important thing people can do right now.
The current climate with COVID and the big economic recession, it affects women quite differently, I think, because they do more than their fair share of caretaking, volunteering. What's your thoughts about this election with respect to women?
Look, women are the drivers of campaigns. They are the volunteers. They are the majority of donors. Like women are driving campaigns and women are doing more than they've ever done before. And I think that has to have an impact. I haven't seen numbers on it yet, and I think we will after this, but I don't see how it doesn't have an impact on campaigns.
Emily, is there a question that I didn't ask that you'd like to answer?
Nothing that I can think of right now. I think you did an excellent job.
I appreciate you taking the time today. Anything else you want to say?
Thank you for doing this show. I'm really excited about how much work can be done over the next couple of weeks until the election. And I know that if people are tuning in, they're thinking about taking the next steps if they're not doing it already.
That was Emily Tisch Sussman and your presidential playlist. Emily's at EmilyTischSussman.com. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.